The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 24th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled, A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, March 28th, 2026.
All right, we're going to carry on with this series on the books of Samuel, and this is now going to be the 24th sermon in the series, which happens to correlate to chapter 24 of 1 Samuel. I feel really good that so far, on average, we are keeping it at one sermon per chapter. That's going to fail in a couple of sermons. We're going to get bogged down on some tangents for reason. But today, hopefully, we're going to carry forward and get through all of chapter 24. Last time, I try and give you a quick summary each time. In the last installment, we covered all of chapter 23, which included poor David on the run from place to place, running from King Saul, who's trying to kill him. We saw in chapter 23 that David saved the people of Keilah, a fortified city in Judah, but near the border with the Philistines. David and his army saved them from the Philistine raids, but he was rewarded by treachery when King Saul attempted to trap him there in the city. God gave him special information through the high priest Abiathar that if he stayed put, that the people of the town would sell him out in order to save themselves with the king. So David and his entourage fled back into the wilderness. So he and 600 men, and it doesn't tell us how many family members of these men may be traveling. I don't know what the full size of this band are. It really only talks in terms of the number of fighting men. But if he's got 600 fighting men with him, we're dealing with a large entourage, and just think about what it would take if you're on the run and literally you're going from place to place in the wilderness, not only to try and find food, but every provision needed to take care of that size of a group. Well, that's what David is doing. And as I mentioned to you last time, this probably is a period in David's life that is extending over up to 10 years. From the time that he first had to begin to flee from Saul in earnest until the time ultimately that Saul's going to be killed and David's going to ascend to the throne. So the storyline that we have through all these chapters does not give us the timeline. So we're putting pieces together, and I can't tell you then each chapter and each storyline how many months or years we are into this, but I presume that here, by the time that we get through chapter 23 and now into chapter 24, David has been in this circumstance now actually for a number of years. Has it been 4 years? Has it been 5 years? Don't know for certain, but it's longer than you might think. We left off with the fact that he fled into the wilderness of Ziph, where Saul almost caught him. Almost had him surrounded, except that God intervened, and because of now this new incursion by the Philistines in the north, Saul had to break off from chasing David and go and take care of that Philistine horde, which saved David to fight another day. And then he moved down into the wilderness of Maon, and then we left off at the end of chapter 23 with David over in the oasis right on the western edge of the Dead Sea called En Gedi. So now before we get into, we're going to cover chapter 24, but before that, I want to stop and insert a couple of these Psalms of David. And I could have done it, maybe should have done that earlier, because there's two particular Psalms, starting with Psalm 57 I want to read. It's got 11 verses in it. But I mentioned to you that part of the story is fleshed out of what David is going through because of the music and the lyrics that he wrote in these psalms that were going on during this very same time. So here is Psalm 57, beginning in verse 1, the introduction says, to the chief musician, I'll Tashith, Michtam of David, when he fled from Saul in the cave. So this reverts back to chapter 22, when he went on the run from Saul and then ended up in that cave of Adullam, if you'll remember, which is where the band of 400 originally came with all of the discontents and the outcasts in the southern part of the kingdom, came together to form this band, which is where I started calling him like Robin Hood. So here is a psalm that David wrote. So if everything else that David is doing and everything else on his mind, and he's having to manage to try and stay alive and keep all of these people, his army, and their families alive as well, he's writing music. This is what he's doing. He's actually writing music during this time and lyrics. So he's written, total, if you look at the number of psalms in the book of Psalms that are attributed to David, there's a lot. And I don't have the count. I'll get that for you at some point in this. But these psalms give you a window into his frame of mind and how he views everything that he's experiencing just besides the storyline telling this, like in the books of Samuel. So what does this introduction tell us? Well, I try and see what the scholars say about it. They say it translates into this, quote, to the chief musician to the tune of Do Not Destroy. That's what this Al-Tashith supposedly is. So in essence, whether this is a tune then that already existed that was known and David just wrote different words to an existing tune, or whether he composed the original music and the name of the music itself is listed. Now, we don't have that preserved historically. Wouldn't it be great if we literally had the music for these psalms? Because that's what a psalm is. It's not just a poem. It's literally lyrics set to music. That's the best I can tell you. A song that was entitled of its own part, Do Not Destroy. What is this word, Michtam? It's debated on the scholars who don't know, but the best estimate is that it actually means specially treasured. So in other words, that this is labeled as a specially treasured psalm that David wrote. And of course, it says when he fled from Saul in the cave. So this is one of the few of the psalms that literally tells you the timing of what was going on when David composed it. So he's fled. He's hiding in a cave. He's in danger of his life from the king who wants nothing more than to destroy him. What does David pray for to God? Let's read it and see. He says, "Be merciful unto me, O God, be merciful unto me, for my soul trusts in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge until these calamities be overpassed." Verse 2, "I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me from the reproach of him that would swallow me up," referring very directly to King Saul. "He shall send from heaven and save me from the reproach of him that would swallow me up," Selah, which is a word, the best that I understand, is almost like a rest. It's like a musical rest. And so when you see that in the Psalms, that's the best way to think about it. "God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. My soul is among lions," meaning predators seeking to devour him. "My soul is among lions, and I lie even among them that are set on fire, when the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows and their tongue a sharp sword." Set on fire, giving you the impression his enemies are adamant. They're not at rest. They're not lackadaisical in orientation. These are enemies who are aggressively seeking to destroy him. That's the environment in which he exists. So how does David pray? How do you pray in your time of greatest trial, persecution, affliction? I tell you how most of us pray. God, Please save me from this affliction. Please hear my prayer. I need your relief. I'm in pain. I'm in agony. I'm facing this dire threat, whatever it may be, body, family, government, circumstance, economic. Please, please, please intervene. Save me, save me, save me. And by the way, let me contact everybody I know in the church and have them pray with me, begging, beseeching God to take away this problem from me. Please solve this problem, Father. And until I get my answer, let me keep haranguing you over and over and over again. Solve my problem. That is not what David is doing here. That's the point I want to make. If you think I'm being overdramatic, fine. But that's what we tend to do and how we spend our time in prayer when we suffer. Now, there are a lot of Psalms of David where he laments his state, where I'm going to say he's more whiny by comparison. But this is not one of them. Because I want you to look at what he's choosing to write in his prayer to God, even though he's under this immense pressure and this threat to life and limb. Verse 5, "Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have digged a pit before me, into the midst whereof they are fallen themselves." David is optimistic here. He's saying, I've got these enemies. They are out to get me. But they're going to fall in their own pit. He had confidence. He's expressing confidence, not fear. And certainly not woe is me orientation. Selah, verse 7. My heart is fixed. O God, my heart is fixed, he repeats. I will sing and give praise. Now, how many of us do that? How many of us in our height of temptation and trial and pain and suffering and sense of loss spend more of our time in prayer actually praising God rather than asking, begging for his intervention? I love this example. I hope you do too. I think it is a key for the people of God. Because there's all kind of people, well-meaning Christians, quote unquote, out there in the world, who get their prayer chains together to pray for each other, begging God to solve their problems. I get it and I understand it. But for the true people of God who have an opportunity to have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, you have an opportunity to manifest this kind of faith and this confidence even in your darkest hour, if you believe. And to spend more of your time thanking God and praising him and remembering that at all times he is a good God no matter what we're experiencing. He deserves our praise at all times. My heart is fixed, O God, my heart is fixed. He's not saying, okay, Father, you promised to heal. You promised to save us. I'm really needing you now. And I want to stay in this church, and I want to stay with this religion, and I want to keep obeying your commandments, but I need you to step up. And by implication, what we're saying is, otherwise I might have to do something else if you don't deliver. I've known a lot of people in God's church over decades who've really, even though they wouldn't admit it, had that frame of mind. Because in essence, they didn't get the miracle by the deadline they imposed upon God, and then they made their choice to do something else. This is the manifestation of an orientation of one who believes in this God and the goodness of this God, no matter what. And spends his time in prayer thanking this God, even though he's in danger of his own death. And he's thanking God. Verse 8, awake up, my glory, awake, psaltery and harp, I myself will awake early. I will praise thee, O Lord, among the people. I will sing unto thee among the nations. Why? Verse 10, for thy mercy is great unto the heavens, and thy truth unto the clouds. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. I think that's stunning. Here's another one, Psalm 52. Also, a psalm apparently written by David during or in the aftermath of events of chapter 22. And I know that's already been two chapters ago, but hopefully it's still fresh in your mind. This one, Psalm 52, begins verse 1, to the chief musician Mashiel, a psalm of David. When Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul and said unto him, David is come to the house of Ahimelech. So you remember that. This is now the Edomite who saw David in Nob when he was with the high priest, but then lied to King Saul about what David was doing there, which caused Saul and his paranoia to condemn 85 priests and all of their families, women and children, to death. And Doeg was the one who volunteered, because even the courtiers of Saul wouldn't kill him, but Doeg and his men would. So now, and if you remember at the end of chapter 22, when Abiathar came and fled, he was the only one out of the entire family of Ahimelech that escaped and went and found David. And the first response of David at the end of chapter 22 was to take responsibility. He felt responsible for the death of all those priests and their families because of having gone to the tabernacle in Nob. And so here he writes this psalm in the wake of these events. And what does David say? Why boastest thou thyself in mischief? He's speaking of Doeg. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endures continually. Thy tongue devises mischiefs like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness, Selah. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. He shall take thee away and pluck thee out of thy dwelling place and root thee out of the land of the living, Selah. So David again is acknowledging this great evil that was perpetrated at the hand of this Edomite. And yet he's showing confidence that God's justice ultimately will be manifested. There is no immediate penalty for Doeg. He seems to get away with what he has done. He truly has committed genocide against the priests of God. David can't solve that. He's in the wilderness fleeing from Saul himself. But he's expressing confidence that in the end, God's justice will prevail. Verse 6, the righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him. Meaning, the righteous, the ones who love and respect and fear God in faith, are not going to be deterred because of the behavior of these enemies who seek the destruction of God's people. Verse 7, lo, this is the man that made not God his strength, referring to the enemy Doeg, but trusted in the abundance of his riches. And he was a wealthy man, one of the powerful men in the service of Saul, and strengthened himself in his wickedness. Verse 8, but I, David says concerning himself, I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise thee forever because thou hast done it. And I will wait on thy name, for it is good before thy saints. Here's his orientation when a great injustice, a great evil has been perpetrated against the people of God. And for the time being, there is no remedy. There is no justice. There is no penalty for the vile and the wicked. And yet David is expressing absolute confidence that the will of a good God is going to be performed. And ultimately there will be justice. And so instead of fretting, he shows confidence. I think it's amazing because, again, remember that David didn't have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. That did not come until the New Testament church began after the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He was moved by God's Spirit. He was motivated and guided very strongly, inspired by God's Spirit. But he still did not have the indwelling like you do. And yet, look the way he expresses the very sentiments, the emotions that God wants from those of us who are members of the body. All right, chapter 24, verse 1. 1 Samuel, chapter 24, verse 1. Here we're going to read. Basically, Saul ends up in the hands of David. Quite by accident or not. So that David has an opportunity to kill his enemy, take matters into his own hands, and solve his problem. So let's read it. Verse 1. It came to pass when Saul was returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. So now the threat on the border is kind of taken care of for now, which means he's back to his number one goal, is to find and slaughter David. All right? David's over with his men over right on the edge of the Dead Sea. And in En-Gedi, verse 2, then Saul took 3,000 chosen men. How determined is he? Very. Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to the sheepcotes, by the way, where was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave. Okay, let's dissect that. First, what are these sheepcotes? They're sheep pens, all right? Simple structures built, in this case, near the opening of caves or in rocky wilderness areas. They were often constructed by piling up loose stones to form a low circular or semicircular wall around the entrance of a cave, or in some cases on an open area. Why? Because then the cave would allow protection for the sheep, either from weather or from the sun, and yet they would build a wall kind of out around it in order to try and keep the sheep in. All right, so that's why you've got a sheep pen, but it's in concert with the opening to a cave. And so Saul and his 3,000 men are hunting David in the wilderness over here near the Dead Sea. Saul needs a rest, apparently. How long did it take him to get down in this area? It's quite probably several days' march to get where they're at. Saul needs a rest. So it doesn't talk about his men resting with him, but Saul is going to take a little bit of a siesta, apparently, in this cave, in the cool of this cave opening that's being used as a sheep pen. Okay, and David and his men, when it says here, David and his men remained in the sides of the cave, the scholars seem to agree what this means is that David and his men were in the inner recesses of the cave. So 600 men, literally, was this a huge cave? And all of them were all hiding deep in this cave system? I don't know. Or was it just David and a few, and the rest of his men scattered other places? Any of those things are possible. We're not given the detail. But David and at least a cohort, probably of his most faithful followers, and there's a reason I'm saying that, because it's going to become important here very soon. They're hiding in this cave. All of a sudden, Saul and his army come up. They can't get out. They have no choice but to hide deeper in the cave. And lo and behold, King Saul comes in and lays down for a nap. That's what's going on here. He's coming in to rest. Verse 4. And the men of David said unto him, Behold, the day of which the Eternal said unto thee, Behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thy hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall deem good unto thee. His men are saying, This is God's work to put Saul in your hands. You can kill him. This is God's will. God promised to deliver you. Here, this is how he's doing it. He's brought your enemy, unbeknownst to you, right into your realm. And he doesn't know you're hiding here. This is your chance. Well, David's men are giving David bad advice, because that is not God's will. They're twisting the scripture to fit their personal desire, which is what we very naturally do. We believe in God, we want to follow God, and through circumstances, we want our problem solved. Oh, this is God's will. God has provided this opportunity. All I got to do is act upon it, and my life is going to be better. And that's how his men, his trusted men, view this circumstance. Very natural. Then, but the end of verse 4, then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privately or in secret. So Saul is in essence asleep. He's right there near the entrance to the cave, and David is able to sneak into that cavern from back deeper. Nobody knows he's there. And just to prove that he had the opportunity to kill Saul, he cuts off a piece of the bottom of the robe of Saul while he's asleep. Now, some commentators was this a robe that Saul had literally on his body? Had he taken off his outer mantle, and was it just nearby? I mean, all those things are possible. But what's important is if David to be able literally to creep in and get next to the king, who's out to get him, trying to find him to kill him, and he's absolutely now vulnerable and in the hands of David, even though he doesn't know it. So David cuts off a piece, a fringe, whatever it is, of the lower part of the robe of King Saul while he's fast asleep. Verse 5. And it came to pass afterward. Now David should have taken heart in the fact that his men are goading him to say, kill him, kill him, kill him. This is your opportunity. It's God's will. He's put him in your hands. And good on David, because he didn't take that advice. But he did think, no, I'm not going to kill him. But what harm is there in taking this piece of Saul's robe to prove I could have killed him? And even after that, what's David's orientation of mind? Verse 5, it came to pass afterward, after he did the deed, that David's heart smote him. Why? What did he do that's so bad? Because he had cut off Saul's skirt, or the fringe, or a portion of the bottom of the robe of Saul. Verse 6, and he, David, said unto his men, The Eternal forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Eternal's anointed. We find it again, even after all these months, probably years that he's been on the road, living, running from place to place in the wilderness like a vagabond. And still, after all of this time, he acknowledges that Saul is still the anointed of God, that God is the one who installed him in that office as king, and only God has the authority to take him out, no matter how evil his character may be. No matter how much he's trying to destroy David. And do you think he would not destroy David's whole family? Sure he would. If he sent Doeg to kill all of the priests and all of their families, do you think he wouldn't kill all of David's family too? Sure he would. And yet, uppermost in the mind of David is the fact that this man, evil that he is still the anointed of God. So even after he gave in to this temptation to cut the bottom hem off the robe of Saul, his heart, his conscience then rose up against him, and he knew that he did something wrong. Now, his men don't think he did anything wrong at all. They think he's being a weenie just because he didn't kill him, left him alive, let alone the fact that now he cuts off a piece of the robe and now David's all like messed up over it. His men are going like, what's going on with you, man? Because they don't think like David. They're not grounded and rooted the way David is concerning these spiritual principles. The Eternal forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Eternal's anointed, to stretch forth mine hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Eternal. See what's uppermost in the mind of David? It's not about the character of the man, it's about the office which is God ordained. Most human beings, including all of the men of David, are like, you know, what's most important is this guy's evil. He's a killer. He's guilty of genocide. You're not guilty of anything, and he's trying to kill you. You have every right to kill him. You have every right to kill him, to defend yourself. And David's the only one out of the whole lot of them that has a different orientation. He's saying, no, though he's my enemy, he's the anointed of the Eternal. He's holding a God-given office, and I have no right to show disrespect, let alone to kill him, not even to show disrespect for him in that office by cutting off a piece of the hem of his robe. This, my dear friends, is what set David apart. One of the reasons that I wanted to do this entire sermon series on the books of Samuel, to point out these critical incidences in the life of David which set him apart from everybody else around him. Acts 13, verse 21. And after they desired a king, and God gave him, this is now the apostles reciting what happened historically. Afterward, they desired a king, and God gave unto them Saul, the son of Cis, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, by the space of 40 years. That's how long Saul was on the throne. And when he had removed him, meaning when God finally removed Saul from that office, he raised up unto them David to be their king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after mine own heart, which shall fulfill all my will. You know how significant that statement is? This is God speaking about a man. And this is literally the legacy that this man David left, which God highlighted to the New Testament church in the book of Acts. I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after mine own heart, which shall fulfill all my will. Whose will was David fulfilling in this cave? If he was being selfish and fulfilling his own will, he would have killed Saul. He didn't do it. And even when he showed disrespect to Saul, he lamented it and he apologized. He acknowledged his sin. Verse 23, of this man's seed, meaning the children that came from King David, hath God, according to his promise, raised unto Israel a Savior, Jesus. God picked King David to be the ancestor of the Messiah. Because of his difference in character, in thinking, in behavior, in orientation. And I will tell you, much of it goes back to his respect for the authority and the will of God, regardless of whether it was convenient for him personally or not. Over everything, he prioritized the will and the purpose and the authority and the manifestation of authority among men of God, rather than what would have been convenient for himself. 1 Samuel 13, let's go back. Of course, we read this quite some time ago. But verse 14, 1 Samuel 13, verse 14, but now thy kingdom, this is now God through Samuel letting Saul know that he blew it. God would have created a dynasty out of Saul so that one of the descendants of Saul would have been the Messiah. That literally is what God offered him. Except Saul demonstrated he didn't have this respect for the authority of God. He did when he was young and when he was still humble, but time and circumstance changed him over the years. Now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Eternal hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Eternal hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Eternal commanded thee. What does God care about? The character. The character of a servant who will never forget that he's obligated to fulfill God's will, not his own. No matter how many years he's been in the office. It was one of the mistakes that Moses made, as even though he was counted faithful in all his house by God in the final analysis. And yet, remember, Moses ultimately got weary and frustrated with the rebellious Israelites, and instead of doing what God told him and speaking to the rock for the miracle of the water to come out, he struck it. And God still fulfilled his will to provide water to save the people, but told Moses, you took things into your own hands, you didn't follow my instruction. And God used it as an example. So the threat is always there, no matter how long we may have fulfilled God's will humbly. We have to do it all the way to the very end. We can always fall off the wagon, if you will, and make a mistake if we get too full of ourselves and forget our obligation. So God highlighted David as one who's seen throughout his life, even though he made many mistakes. And we haven't gotten to all the mistakes of David yet. Only a few of them. Few by nature. His biggest mistakes, including adultery and murder, is upcoming. But in spite of those mistakes, the thing that set David apart, he always remembered the authority of God. He was the servant of God. He was obligated to fulfill God's will and to show respect for God and his work and his will, regardless of how inconvenient it might be to him personally. It absolutely set him apart. And God said it made him a man after his own heart. What can you and I take from that? Is there something that we can apply personally? If you think your little life doesn't matter and the decisions you have to make day by day, year by year, are inconsequential, no, they're not. You have an opportunity to make choices, even if they're not life and death, but you have an opportunity to make choices to either demonstrate that God and his will and his purpose and his commandments are first or not. And you have just as much an opportunity as David did to show that you are a man or a woman after God's own heart by your choices. Isaiah 48, verse 28. Just the last one in my little tangent detour. Here's a prophecy. It related specifically here to King Cyrus of Persia. And yet, it expresses this sentiment about God's respect for those who will do his will instead of their own. Isaiah 48:28. That saith, and so I'm not reading the whole passage, you can do that yourself. Isaiah 48, 28, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. So here, even a pagan king was an instrument of God in allowing the Israelites, the Jews, to come back out of captivity. Back to 1 Samuel 24. It applies not only to Cyrus, it applies to the orientation of David, it applies to the orientation that Jesus Christ himself showed to us. That is the common denominator that God is looking for in all of his servants. Back to 1 Samuel 24, verse 7, so David stayed his servants with these words, meaning he prevented them from taking things into their own hands to kill Saul when Saul was vulnerable and in their hands, and suffered them not to rise against Saul. But Saul rose up out of the cave and went on his way, never even knowing that he was in danger of his life. David and his band never revealed themselves. Saul has his nap, he gets up, he goes on his way and has no clue what all took place. Verse 8, now we have David's speech to Saul. Verse 8, David also arose afterward and went out of the cave and cried after Saul. I don't know how far away he was. He obviously was in earshot. He's able to call to Saul, and Saul hears him, saying, my lord the king. Again, he's showing respect for the office that Saul holds. My lord the king. And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed himself. And David said to Saul, wherefore hearest thou men's words, saying, behold, David seeks thy hurt? David says to Saul, why have you listened to those men around you who said, I was trying to harm you? He's saying they were lies. I never tried to harm you or disrespect you. Wherefore hearest thou men's words, saying, behold, David seeks thy hurt? Why did you listen to these others? Behold, this day thine eyes have seen how the Eternal hath delivered thee today into my hands in the cave. Must have been a shock for Saul to find out. David was right there the whole time. And some, David says, bade me kill thee. My men wanted me to take advantage of it and slaughter you right there in your sleep. But mine eye spared thee. And I said, I will not put forth mine hand against my Lord, for he is the Eternal's anointed. Verse 11, moreover, my father. David calls Saul his father. Fascinating. Moreover, my father, see the skirt of thy robe in my hand. For in that I cut off the skirt of thy robe, and killed thee not. He says, I was close enough right there that I could have killed you. And all I did instead was just cut off a piece of your garment. Know thou and see that there is neither evil nor transgression in my hand, and I have not sinned against thee. Yet thou huntest my soul to take it. I have no ill will against you, David is saying, and yet you're trying to kill me. Verse 12, the Eternal judge between me and thee, and the Eternal avenge me of thee. David is respectfully pointing out the fact that he's being chased and condemned by Saul without a cause. But instead of condemning Saul, he's appealing to God and to God's justice. The Lord avenge me of thee, but mine hand shall not be upon thee. I will not seek to destroy you to save myself. Verse 13, as saith the proverb of the ancients. Where is this proverb? It's nowhere else in the Bible, by the way. So David is now quoting a wise saying, a proverb that was documented at the time, which God did not choose to preserve and bring down to us. But what was this proverb? He's quoting it. Wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but mine hand shall not be upon thee. So there's some old adage that applied in other times, in generations past, that David is applying to his current circumstance with Saul. Wickedness proceeds from the wicked, But he says, my hand shall not be upon thee. And the sentiment is, now we have, there's other actual proverbs, many statements in the Bible that support the sentiment that's involved here. In our modern day, I would say one that applies, one that you know very well, two wrongs don't make a right. Because isn't that the common thing that we as carnal human beings do? Somebody disrespects us, harms us, takes something from us, and therefore we say, we throw down and say, aha, you started it, now I'm going to finish it. I have a right to defend myself. If you attack me, if you take something from me, I have a right to retaliate. That's good carnal human reasoning. The proverb David's quoting says, evil people always do evil. But in essence, the righteous do not justify evil acts just because they were the ones that were goaded. Two wrongs don't make a right. In spite of how much David, quote, carnally has a right to defend himself, he's saying, I will not play tit for tat with King Saul, because he is the Lord's anointed. Matthew 12:33, to emphasize this principle, Matthew 12:33, Jesus Christ says, either make the tree good and his fruit good, or else make the tree corrupt and his fruit corrupt. Find out what kind of a tree you're dealing with. You've got all these people claiming that they're good, that they're telling you the truth. They're representing God or they're whatever. They're saying, trust me. And God is, and Jesus Christ is saying here, test the fruits. Test the fruit of a tree and you'll find out. You know, you can stand there and stare at the apple tree and decide whether you think it's a good tree or not. The best way to find out, pick the fruit and eat it. Find out if it's good or not. And that's exactly then what Jesus Christ is saying. You and I have an opportunity to test the fruits of anybody who's claiming that they deserve respect. Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or else make the tree corrupt and its fruit corrupt. For the tree is known by his fruit. O generation of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? He's saying to these Jewish leaders who are claiming to be righteous and the pillars of the community. And Christ is calling them out saying, no, you're not. For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. A good man out of the good treasure of the heart brings forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. You can tell by the choices that people make, especially under pressure, what is their character. You, in time, now maybe for certain individuals, you don't know. You can't read hearts and minds, and neither can I. But in the end, what Christ is saying is, you have an opportunity to see what is the real orientation behind the veil. Because people will reveal themselves by what they do. So don't prejudge. Do not make the mistake of drawing conclusions about somebody else when you don't know, because you'll make a serious mistake. But in the end, you find out. And as it applies to King David, or David and King Saul here back in 1 Samuel 24, now verse 14, David is saying, look at the fruits. You've had people around you tell you that I am a bad tree, that I'm out to get you. And he says, that is not true. That's always been a lie. I have never tried to disrespect you. And here is proof of it, because you were in my hands and I could have killed you. And how he could have saved himself all of this misery and this anguish and this threat to himself and his family. And he did not avail himself of it because he respected God more. Was David demonstrating the fruits of a good tree or an evil tree? Saul has got the track record of showing. His motivation is all about personal greed, paranoia, pride. His fruits are evil. David's have been good. David is respectfully pointing this out to King Saul. Verse 14, after whom, David is asking Saul, after whom is the king of Israel come out? Who are you chasing with your 3,000 men out here in the desert? Why are you here? What is your purpose? Who is so important that you're expending this much energy and manpower? Whom is the king of Israel come out? After whom dost thou pursue? After a dead dog? After a flea? That's how David views himself. Humbly. Is not worth this effort by the king. Because in essence, David is saying, I'm no threat to you. I'm not trying to undermine you. I am not going to try to remove you from the throne. You are in no danger from me. You need not worry and spend all your time and treasure on trying to expunge me. No harm is going to come to you at my hand. I'm no different than a dead dog or a flea. Verse 15, David ends by saying, the eternal therefore be judge, and judge between me and thee, and see, and plead my cause, and deliver me out of thine hand. In essence, David, by putting himself in the hands of God, is saying, you know, if you're able to kill me, maybe that'll be proof that I was evil. But he says, I'm not going to take things, matters into my own hands to solve my own problems by killing you. I'm willing to put myself in the hands of God and let God demonstrate by what happens next, whether I was a good tree or an evil tree, whether I was producing good fruit or evil. That takes faith. Verse 16, now we have Saul's reply. He just heard the soliloquy of David after he escaped death unbeknownst. Must have been shocking for him to turn around and find out he was in the hands of David the whole time. Verse 16, and it came to pass when David had made an end of speaking these words unto Saul that Saul said, is this thy voice, my son David? So David called him father, and now Saul is calling David son. Is this thy voice, my son David? So he must have been far enough away that maybe it was hard to see him to be certain. So I envision this, I don't know, bit or distance apart. And now where are these 3,000 men of Saul? Here David and Saul are having this conversation. And where's the army of Saul? I don't know. But David and his men are not in immediate danger or threat, or so it seems. Saul said, is this thy voice, my son David? And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. Was Saul emotionally affected by the speech of David and the circumstance? You bet he was. Was he repentant? No. And that's going to be proven out by all the events that happen next in the storyline. But for the moment, is it true that Saul was emotionally affected and sorry for his efforts to kill David? Yes. Was Saul sincere in changing his mind and deciding not to try to kill David anymore? Yes. But remember that Saul is weak in mind. He's been influenced by evil spirits who have goaded him into these dark moods, as we saw in earlier chapters. Which means Saul is not in total control of himself. He's subject to these mood swings, which is why in one time he would embrace David and the next time he's trying to throw a spear at him and kill him. This is the same unreliable character. It's just for the moment now, Saul is overwhelmed by this positive emotion by David, and who can deny the fact that David spared his life when he had a chance to kill him? Verse 17, and he said to David, thou art more righteous than I. I think he's speaking sincerely. Thou art more righteous than I, for thou hast rewarded me good, whereas I have rewarded thee evil. I've been trying to kill you, and yet you've demonstrated you're not trying to kill me in return or harm me in any way. Verse 18, and thou hast showed this day how that thou hast dealt well with me. For as much as when the Eternal had delivered me into thine hand, thou killedst me not. So Saul acknowledges, in essence, that God is the one who supernaturally created the circumstance to put Saul literally in the hands of David. Now, remember, the men of David said, God's given us this. God has put him in your hands. Take advantage of it. Kill him. It's just his right. Saul acknowledges that God put him in David's hands. And they were both right. Of course, David's men got wrong about what David was supposed to do. Do you think that was a test of David? Yes. Do you think God created that circumstance literally to demonstrate what David's character was? Yes. That's why we have the story. And without it, you would be missing one of the key pieces that tell you how David is different than almost everyone else. Saul is acknowledging now that David is different than everyone else, because you would expect someone in David's position, who is lauded by the masses after killing Goliath and being exalted now, with songs being sung about him, that he would aspire to take over the throne. But David didn't. Saul is having to acknowledge that David is not acting carnally. He's acting righteously. And Saul is acknowledging his behavior has not been equal. As when the Lord hath delivered me into thine hand, you didn't kill me. Verse 19, for if a man find his enemy, will he let him go well away? What's a normal human being going to do in this circumstance? He finds his enemy, his mortal enemy, within his power. Who's not going to take advantage of that? Wherefore, the Eternal reward thee good. Saul is now pronouncing a blessing upon David. Because of what you have done to show your character, and not killing me when I was right there, the Eternal reward thee good, for that thou hast done unto me this day. Let God bless you, David, because of what you did in sparing my life. Proverb 25, verse 21 says, if thine enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. If he be thirsty, give him water to drink. So this isn't just a New Testament principle. Actually, you're going to see that in the upcoming monthly letter, not written by me, but coincidentally with a number of these same texts. Thine enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. If he be thirsty, give him water to drink. For thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head, and the Eternal shall reward thee. This story in chapter 24 of 1 Samuel is an exact example of this principle. David would have been expected to take advantage of the situation to eliminate an enemy, and instead, he did good to his enemy. And what is the result? Saul feels guilty. He, in essence, has had heaps of coal. Coals of fire heaped upon his head. That's how he feels right now, legitimately, emotionally, sincerely. He knows there's a difference. Now, this is, so you and I, you know, like if somebody smacks you, you're supposed to do good to them in return. Yes, Matthew 5. Let's go to Matthew 5, just verse 43 through 48. You know it very well. But it's the New Testament mirror, if you will, of Proverb 25, 21 through 22. Matthew 5, 43, Christ said, you have heard it been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy, because that's the way human beings behave. But I, verse 44, say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. This is exactly what David is doing. Now, why is David doing it? Because his enemy is in an office appointed by God, and he should be showing that respect to God. And why? Why put ourselves out when we have an opportunity? It's in our grasp to solve our problems and to take away this thorn in the side, which is threatening me, my family, my circumstances. I could solve it. It's right here. All I got to do is act. And why would we not? People in the world would. Because the people of God are being held to a different standard. To think about the Creator and His will and His purposes and His laws and His commandments more so than what would make our lives more easy. Why love your enemies and bless them? Why pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you? Verse 45, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. That's why. That you may behave like the true children of God, not the children of men. That I may show our focus on something bigger and more important than our immediate need. For he makes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and on the unjust, and God does. And in David's circumstance, Saul was getting the benefit of God's grace for the moment, because God was not holding Saul accountable. Oh, don't assume Saul was a happy guy. No, he wasn't. He was miserable. And yet he was being spared from the judgment he deserved for the moment. Verse 46, for if you love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? Yeah, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. That's just business. You have something to offer me, I have to offer you something in return. That's trade. That's commerce. That has nothing to do with righteousness. I love the way Mr. Armstrong put it many, many years ago when he talked about the empirical self. Made it into the old Correspondence Course series of the 60s. Can't remember which one on human nature. 21, 24, somewhere in there. He absolutely nailed it when he said our natural nature. Now, in human beings love to do good things. You'll see that the author of the April Monthly Letter that's just now coming out makes the same point. We love to do good to our family and to our close friends and to our business associates. But that's just because we make these people an extension of our empirical self. Just because people in the world do nice things and gestures and give to charities and do this and do that doesn't mean they're fulfilling the spiritual righteousness of God's character. It's still a part of their selfishness, their greed, their carnality. Because all they've done is taken their greedy self-defense and expanded it to include other people they care about. And because they care about these people, they're going to share good things with them. The empirical self, I love it. It says so much about our motivation for what we do. But show me somebody who's willing to put themselves at a disadvantage in order to do what's right when they get no benefit from it. Now you're talking about something totally different, which is why Jesus Christ pointed it out in Matthew 5. To say the children of God behave totally differently than the people of the world. Back to 1 Samuel 24, verse 20. At the end of Saul's speech back to David, his lament, he says, and now behold, I know well that thou shalt surely be king. Isn't that amazing? Saul has been trying to kill David all of these months and years to try to prevent the potential of David ascending to the throne at his expense and his family's. And now Saul says, I know well that thou shalt surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in thy hand. Amazing. And so, with that sentiment, Saul has now a request of David. In this moment of clarity, in essence, a drowning man has been able to fight to the surface to take a breath. That's the way I see Saul at this moment. He has a moment of clarity. He sees things now accurately from God's perspective. He knows David is going to become king. And with that fact in his mind, now he asks David a favor. Verse 21, swear now, therefore, unto me by the Eternal. Similar to the fact that his son Jonathan has entered in these covenants with God, with David, recognizing David is going to become the king, and therefore Jonathan saying, I know, I believe this is going to be true, therefore, make a covenant with me that you'll take care of me and my family when you ascend to the throne and have that power. Saul is, in essence, doing the same thing here. Swear now, therefore, unto me by the Eternal, that thou wilt not cut off my seed after me, and that thou wilt not destroy my name out of my father's house. He says, affirm to me in the name of the God that you fear, that when God puts you on the throne, that you will not use that authority in order to wipe out my family, which is what a normal human carnal king would do. The first thing you do if you get the opportunity, you eliminate everyone who might later try to claim the throne and to rise up and get people to back him in order to kick you off so he can get on it, king of the mountain. That's what human beings do. That's what they have done in kingdoms around the world, you know, from the beginning. The new one comes on, he tries to destroy everyone who was a part of the old. We're seeing it more now, even, you know, in politics. We're like democracies. We're actually, in this country, a constitutional republic. Now, let me not get into that. But now we're acting more and more like third world countries who we used to laugh at. And what do? One rises up with power to kick off the other. And what do? They either kill or prosecute the previous king, the previous president, prime minister, whatever. Lawfare. For what reason? Because they're all guilty of something. But do they really care about right and wrong? No! They care about taking away the potential for that previous power, family structure, cabal, whatever, from now threatening them in the future. So accuse them of crimes and try to put them in jail. And that's what we're doing in our country as well. A new administration comes on and they prosecute the members of the last. It's the same spirit. And it's been going on through all the history of humanity. And Saul is begging David, when God puts you on the throne, which in this moment of clarity he sees is going to be true, he says, promise me that you won't do that to my family, that you won't kill my children and my grandchildren in order to safeguard your throne, that thou will not cut off my seed after me, and that thou will not destroy my name out of my father's house. Verse 22, and David sware unto Saul. I'll stop right there. So David promised Saul, I will not kill your family. So one, David seems to be acknowledging that he is going to be king, which is in itself significant. Not refuting Saul and saying, oh, what are you talking about, Saul? I'm not going to be king. He's acknowledging it. And in essence, he's saying, I promise to you, King Saul, when I become king, I will not lift my hand against your family. Now, does that mean that the family of Saul is not going to be slaughtered? Oh, no. David would not be the one to wipe out Saul's children, but God would. Because this is already a prophecy that God gave to Saul back through Samuel, that because of his unfaithfulness, that he is not going to have a dynasty. And Saul went home, but David and his men gat them up unto the hold. Wait a minute. They went back up into the mountains, into the wilderness, the strongholds. Why? I thought they were reconciled. Saul now is all favorable toward David. David and his men should come out of exile, go back to Gibeah. He should be, you know, right back in the court again, right? Apparently not. Why? Wisely, David does not trust this change of heart manifested by Saul at all. Good for him, because he knows Saul is not trustworthy. Saul is sincere in the moment in what he's saying. But David knows, based on past behavior, it's not going to last. And it's only a matter of time before Saul reverts the very same paranoia. The dark clouds are going to come over him again. He's going to begin to view David as his enemy. And he's going to be right back to trying to destroy him. Next time now, we're going to continue the storyline in chapter 25, which is going to include the death, finally, of Samuel. And, for the most part, the saga of David, Nabal, and Abigail. Next time.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 24th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, March 28th, 2026.